Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. The 2004 publication of photographs showing U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison brought the issue of torture to the forefront of public discussion. In the ensuing years, more and more information has surfaced indicating that the United States has abused prisoners at other locations, including the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In today's program, we take a close look at the actual techniques of torture used at American installations and ask, were these torture techniques improvised, on the spot, by rogue personnel, or were they the product of long-term research and development programs funded by the U.S. government? Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, The Road to Abu Ghraib. Welcome back to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. In today's program, we're going to take a close look at the modern history of torture. To help us understand this important subject, we're very fortunate to have with us Professor Alfred W. McCoy. Professor McCoy received his PhD from Yale and teaches history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Much of Professor McCoy's work focuses on illuminating the operations of the covert netherworld. His book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, which the CIA tried to suppress, was published in 1972. It's now in its third edition and is regarded as the classic work on the global drug trade. More recently, Professor McCoy turned his attention to the issue of torture, and in 2006, he published A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. A film based in part on that book, Taxi to the Dark Side, won the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature in 2008. Professor McCoy, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Ken, for having me. Appreciate it.
Many people have seen the photos from the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, published in April 2004, showing U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi prisoners. Photos show things like naked prisoners forced to pile on top of each other, naked prisoners led by U.S. soldiers on dog leashes and threatened by attack dogs. And there's a particularly famous photo which shows a prisoner with a hood over his head who's been forced to stand on a box with his arms extended while attached to wires. Was this the work of a few bad apples, or is there a pedigree to this behavior?
When those photos were first released back in April 2004, most people, like Donald Rumsfeld himself, dismissed the behavior as aberrant. William Safire, the conservative New York Times columnist, looked at the photos and said this was the work of people he called creeps. I looked at those photos because I'd been working on torture at that point for nearly 15 years, and I said, oh, clear. CIA foundational doctrines, the foundation for their psychological torture paradigm. The victim is hooded for sensory deprivation, and he's standing on a box in forced standing or self-inflicted pain. Sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain were the two key techniques that the CIA developed in a decade of very costly, very aggressive mind control research during the darkest days of the Cold War back in the 1950s. But right after World War II, there was this concerted attempt to scoop up the best of Nazi research, and one of the units we picked up was the Luftwaffe Aviation Medical Research Unit that did those notorious experiments on victims at Dachau. You've seen the photographs, they're exhibited at the Dachau Museum, of prisoners being lowered into water and that sort of thing. That same unit actually did work on the impact of mescaline for interrogation on behalf of the Gestapo.
That was Dr. Kurt Plotner?
Yes, that's right.
You mentioned that he had an influence on Harvard's Dr. Henry Beecher.
Yeah, it's an untold story. Today, Henry K. Beecher is actually quite famous as the founder of modern clinical ethics in the United States. In 1966, he wrote a famous article called Ethics in Clinical Research, in which he had a couple dozen anonymous cases showing how researchers had sacrificed the interests of their subject or their patient in order to advance science. And he said this was unethical. He condemned it. And that led to the creation of what are called human subjects committees or institutional review boards in every hospital, every human science research unit in the United States. Ironically, however, Professor Beecher spent most of the previous 15 years as a covert drug researcher for the U.S. Army and the CIA. The U.S. Army Surgeon General sent Beecher Dr. Plotner's reports from Dachau in 1947. And that report stated that mescaline could prize open the human mind and make people confess to things that they and say things they otherwise wouldn't reveal. Beecher, as a professor of anesthesiology at Harvard, thought that this was the key to unlocking the human mind for interrogation for the military. And he went on a 15-year quest to find the perfect drug that would do this work. And first he thought it was mescaline. And he went to Germany in 1950 and 51. He went to the U.S. Army's European Command Interrogation Center, where there was a squad that tortured and unwilling escapees or defectors. It was the former Luftwaffe Interrogation Center, Dahlag Luft Interrogation Center, taken over by the U.S. military and used as an interrogation facility, staffed with ex-Nazi doctors and ex-Gestapo soldiers. And the CIA had a secret safe house nearby in a German country house, House Waldorf. And this facility was visited by Beecher, where he met with these people, with the interrogators, and discussed with them the development of drugs. Then the U.S. military sent him the reports from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company in Switzerland, the early reports about the impact of LSD. And finding that mescaline wasn't working, Beecher then became an enthusiastic researcher in LSD. And he used Massachusetts General Hospital to test LSD on unwitting subjects, you know, and ramping up the dosages, blasting their brains with it, trying to use it to break them down. Ironically, a few years later in the early 1960s, when Timothy Leary was at Harvard and there were a number of young faculty who were experimenting with the drug LSD for liberation, Beecher wrote an article in the Harvard Theological Journal condemning the use and of LSD by young people as completely responsible and utterly unethical. He managed to conceal his 15 years of research for the U.S. military.
And as it turned out, the LSD did not turn out to be the truth serum, the magic bullet they were looking for.
Well, actually, you're correct. There were really two strands to this mind control research. There were the exotic techniques, hypnosis, electroshock, and drugs. And the CIA did much of this experimentation in-house. They did a lot of LSD testing in-house, as we know. And there was a tragic accident, which somebody was unwittingly given a dosage of LSD. Dr. Olson jumped from a hotel room in New York City to his death. And President Ford apologized to the widow and the children of Dr. Olson for that experimentation. But by the late 1950s, early 1960s, it was becoming clear that none of these exotic techniques, none of this research that the CIA was doing in-house under very unethical procedures, none of it was working. But what was working, ironically, was the boring, banal behavioral research that they outsourced to leading universities in the United States and Canada. And it's here that the real breakthroughs occurred. The first and fundamental breakthrough was made by a very famous cognitive scientist, a man named Professor Donald O. Hebb. Many people attribute the origins of modern cognitive science to his work. He got a contract at the behest of the CIA through the Canadian government's Defense Research Board at McGill University. And he found that by subjecting student volunteers from McGill, many of them medical students, to goggles, gloves, and earmuffs, that he could induce a state akin to psychosis in 24, sometimes it would take 48 hours. First, there would be extraordinary hallucinations, just beyond all imagining, little paper men coming out of white hills, stuff that was beyond what you'd get from mescaline, and then a breakdown.
So you'd be in like a cubicle, you say, with translucent goggles and no sound and a pillow under your head, so you were meant to feel nothing?
You were absolutely comfortable. Air-conditioned cubicle, no sound, no feel, no sight. That's it. You just cut off three senses.
They achieved psychosis in 2 days.
In 2 days. A complete breakdown. That's why when you look at, those 1,600 photos from Guantanamo, almost all of the detainees, whatever their circumstance, whether they're in their cells, whether they're shackled, wherever they are, they've got bags on their head. They're being deprived of sight to induce the breakdown. If you want to know what HEB students look like, just look at the photographs of the early detainees in their orange jumpsuits at Guantanamo. They had gloves, goggles, and earmuffs on. They were being subjected, even when they were being brought outside supposedly to get exercise and air, they were still maintaining the sensory deprivation to accelerate the breakdown. The next breakthrough came at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City, and there were two famous neuroscientists that were working there under long-term contract to the CIA. They were given access to the agency and the government files on KGB, including interviews with people that had escaped the Iron Curtain, defectors and the like. And after reviewing this detailed research on KGB torture techniques, these two Cornell University medical researchers discovered that the most effective KGB torture technique was none of the physical abuse, but was their procedure for making the victim stand immobile for days at a time while fluids flowed to the legs. They erupted in separating lesions, hallucinations set in, all of this incredibly painful.
This is Lawrence Hinkle and Harold Wolf.
That's correct, yes. Very respected in their day, and working covertly in a long-term contract for the CIA. And then in 1963, after basically a decade plus of this research, the CIA then summarized and codified the findings from as much as $25 million of cognitive science research. The whole CIA effort in mind control research was probably $1 billion at peak in the 1950s. And they summarized this in the QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual. And basically what they elaborate upon are these two basic techniques, sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain. And that was then proliferated, disseminated through the U.S. intelligence community and then through U.S. training programs by CIA and the U.S. military to our allies, particularly our third world allies abroad.
Could you talk about its use of these techniques in the Vietnam Phoenix program?
Yeah, the Phoenix program it comes almost immediately after the CIA sort of finishes this decade of very experimental research. Now, you've got to remember, the aim for all this work was to essentially allow them to work very heavily, very effectively on individual defectors or double agents. Somebody who comes across the Iron Curtain, purports to be defecting from the KGB, giving you information, how do you tell if it's accurate? So that's the point of this. In other words, individual elite subjects. Suddenly the CIA plunged into South Vietnam. And as they're part of the war effort, they established, first of all, a series of interrogation centers that ultimately elaborated into the Phoenix program. And it had 40 provincial prisons, and then regional interrogation center, and then a national interrogation center. And the CIA was charged with, in effect, breaking the Viet Cong infrastructure. And so they centralize all data on suspected members of the Viet Cong underground through computers. They pumped it out to these regional and local interrogation centers. And then the CIA had mercenary squads made up of hired killers, murderers, and the like, who were all tattooed killers. They had the word Sat Cong, kill commies, tattooed on their upper arm, very visible, so they couldn't defect. And these squads of killers would go out, pick up the target, bring them back for torture interrogation. It was a massive program that, by the CIA's count, led to 26,000 extrajudicial executions. The South Vietnamese police, who were partners in this program, lay claim to another 20,000. So we're looking at a total of 46,000 extrajudicial executions.
Could you talk about the psychological techniques used by the CIA agent Frank Snepp on the Viet Cong prisoner named Thai?
Yeah, that's a good example of the ultimate or the original intention of the CIA program, to focus it on top-level defectors or captives. And this was a captive. He was a ranking member of the Vietnamese Communist Party, been captured in the South, and they focused enormous effort on breaking him down individually. He had his own safe house where he was confined. And in this safe house, there was an all-white room, and then the one thing that this Vietnamese couldn't stand, cold. They had high-powered air conditioners blasting him around the clock. And they kept him there for years, trying to break him down. He never cracked. He's evidently a very dedicated communist cadre. He never, ever broke. And then when Saigon was falling in 1975, they executed him rather than release him. The CIA paradigm, as originally developed, is really kind of a broad brush application. What it's trying to get to the mind through the six senses, you know, the five basic senses and, of course, the sense of time. And you're manipulating those senses in various combinations of sensory deprivation and sensory overload, and break down those senses and then get into the mind and break down the individual using those senses as the pathway to the brain. This is a more sophisticated operation because they're actually going for individual fears and phobias, attachment to family, fear of cold, positive and negative, and they're playing upon that. And that's the next step in the development of the paradigm that we did see in Iraq. Actually, we saw it, it was really at Guantanamo Bay. In 2002-2003, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld appointed a very aggressive commander to Guantanamo Bay, General Jeffrey Miller. And under General Miller, at the orders of Secretary Rumsfeld, when they set aside the Geneva Conventions, the UN Convention Against Torture, and they were allowed to experiment on detainees. And they turned Guantanamo Bay during that period into a de facto behavioral science laboratory for the perfection of the CIA's paradigm.
So you can actually trace this technique from the experiments in 1950s through the Kubark Manual, Vietnam Phoenix Program, and then you mentioned Project X in Latin America and all the manuals generated in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, right through to General Jeffrey Miller.
There's an absolute line of institutional continuity within the U.S. intelligence and covert community. But this was the next step in advancing the paradigm beyond the original discovery of sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain. Again, trying to get to the mind, break down the mind through the pathways of sensory stimuli. And the first thing they did was that under General Miller, they created what they called behavioral science consultation teams, biscuit teams, of military psychologists who were supposed to and did observe the detainees, also mined their individual medical files to discover individual fears and phobias, such as attachment to mother or fear of dark. They also then experimented with the idea of attacking cultural identity. In this case, they were dealing with Islamic males who were believed to have a sort of sexual reservations or enormous reservations about any contact with females. So they used a lot of female interrogators in very transgressive modes of faking, touching them with menstrual blood, which is deemed to be defiling in certain forms of Islamic belief. And also believing that Arabs were afraid of dogs, regarded dogs as a lower creature, so using dogs in interrogation. And at the end of several months of this very aggressive experimentation, under General Miller, Guantanamo had effectively perfected the CIA's paradigm. Level one, you still use the sensory assault. You put people in dark, or you bring them out of dark and you give them strobe lights. So you mix and match surfeit and denial of sensory stimulus, heat and cold, light and dark, sound and silence. You add to this then the individual fears and phobias, attachment to mother, and then the cultural overlay, the fear of dogs, the reservations about contact with women. And you've got then a total assault, a total three-level assault on the human psyche, sensory stimuli, cultural identity, individual psyche, fears and phobias. And General Miller then...
I'm sorry, he exercised this on Al-Qahtani at Guantanamo, no?
They did everything to him. They made him stand, they short-shackled him, long-shackled him, they subjected him to dark and light, strobe lights, they subjected him to heat and cold.
They forced him to wear women's clothes?
Yeah, the panties on the head, the woman's undergarments on the head, the shouting, the degradation, female interrogators, the entire array, trying to mine his medical records for fears and phobias. It was a total assault on him.
And then, as you say, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld ordered General Miller to bring these techniques to Iraq.
That's right. Just before Abu Ghraib happened in August and September 2003, General Jeffrey Miller, who by this time had redacted his techniques to a tidy manual and CD, went to Abu Ghraib, went to Iraq, briefed the U.S. commander of in Iraq of the day, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, his military intelligence commander, disseminated these techniques to interrogators in Abu Ghraib. And so what you're seeing at Abu Ghraib is a replication of those techniques. We've seen about, I don't know, 30 or 40 photographs. I've got a CD from the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command of the 1,600 photos, the set from Abu Ghraib.
Can you tell us about some of the pictures?
Well, I mean, first of all, they're everything you've seen, and they're worse. And when you sit there and go through 1,600 of these things, I mean, first of all, there's this overwhelming feeling of revulsion. It's like you've entered some kind of Dantesque level of hell. I mean, it's utterly demoralized. And so what you can see there in those photos, all 1,600, and they come down to very, very simple, really four types of techniques over and over again as nauseam. Hooded for sensory deprivation, short-shackled, long-shackled for self-inflicted pain, dogs and nudity and simulated sexuality to attack Arab cultural identity. We can't, of course, see in there if there's any kind of attack on individual psyche, because those are more subtle techniques that won't actually be visibly represented in a photograph.
And yet, as you write, in World War II, there was a successful interrogator named Major Sherwood Moran who did not resort to torture.
During World War II, the U.S. Marine Corps had an interrogator, a man named Major Sherwood Moran, who had been a Christian missionary in Japan before the war, and he was fluent in the language, which is critical for interrogation. And so when he was given Japanese prisoners of war, he treated them as human beings. He established empathy, and he found that even though we imagine these Japanese to be fanatics, everything that we think of Al-Qaeda today, we thought of the Japanese army back then, you know, loyal to the emperor, worshiping like a god, completely fanatical, inhumane, willing to be kamikazes, to do suicide bombing, okay, the first suicide aircraft were, of course, kamikazes. Okay. So, you know, everything we think about Al-Qaeda today, we thought about them then. Moran found, miraculously, that these guys would give information. So impressed were the Marine Corps and the U.S. Navy with the results that they trained an entire corps of Japanese-speaking interrogators and found that, let's say, when they landed on Saipan and Tinian in the Pacific Campaign, that they could get the most detailed order of battle intelligence from Japanese captives within 24 hours.
And they used establishing intellectual and spiritual rapport with the prisoner as their technique.
You have a conversation with a person as a human being. You bond with them emotionally. Of course, you're doing it in a situation of a marked power imbalance. After all, you're armed, they're disarmed, they're captives, you know, they're afraid. So there is an inherent coercive element, but you break through that through this empathy. And the FBI used this technique quite effectively in counterintelligence from 1942, when the FBI was given exclusive control over U.S. counterintelligence by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, right up to 2002, when the Bush administration stripped the FBI of its lead role in counterintelligence and turned all the al-Qaeda captives over to the CIA.
Doesn't it seem illogical then to have gone down the road of the psychological torture instead of Major Sherwood Moran's approach, which has proved effective? Why did Vice President Cheney, what President Bush and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld go down the road they went down?
I think, first of all, the strongest factor is this institutional history of 60 years. We have the lead U.S. intelligence agency developing interrogation doctrines, coercive interrogation doctrines, that they claim work, that produce results. And they've propagated these techniques throughout the U.S. intelligence community, okay, so that they're there, lying to be rediscovered. And we never really broke with those techniques. In 1994, when we, under President Clinton, ratified the U.N. Convention Against Torture, right away we began engaging in rendition. Between 1994 and 2001, we engaged in the rendition of 75 individuals by the count of George Tenet, CIA director. So we broke the treaty even as we signed it. There is therefore an absolute unbroken continuity of our use of torture for 60 years. The other factor, I think, is that torture has a very powerful appeal that we don't understand. It appeals, I think, to some darkly erotic aspect of the human mind. Therefore, the perpetrators, when they do it, always ramp up the techniques. And whenever torture is introduced, you know, directed just at a few very selected captives, it proliferates rapidly, the torture of hundreds, sometimes thousands. And so it has a very powerful psychological appeal.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, Professor McCoy. You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking with Professor Alfred McCoy about his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation, From the Cold War to the War on Terror. And I'll be right back. In his book, Professor McCoy identifies many other prominent behavioral scientists who contributed to the U.S. government's torture research. In 1949, Yale psychologist Irving Janis studied Soviet brainwashing techniques used to extract confessions and concluded that these techniques were more successful than physical torture. In 1961, leading sociologist Albert Biderman reported that psychological torture seemed the ideal way of breaking down a prisoner, because, quote, the effect of isolation on the brain function is much like that which occurs if he's beaten, starved, or deprived of sleep. University of Pennsylvania psychiatrist George E. Ruff and Princeton psychologist Jack A. Vernon separately conducted government-funded research on the use of sensory deprivation in interrogation. Ewan Cameron, head of McGill's psychiatric treatment facility, subjected patients to behavioral experiments which included drug-induced comas for up to 86 days, as well as requiring a subject to wear a football helmet for 21 days, with a tape repeating hundreds of thousands of times messages like, "My mother hates me." Yale professor Stanley Milgram conducted experiments for the government in which volunteers were asked by a person with a white coat to press a switch, which they were told gave lethal electric shocks to innocent victims. 65% of volunteers pressed the switch, and nearly 100% went along if their role was just to assist. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc., B.J. McDermott Rowe, Technical Director. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.